Welcome to New Books in Language. Today I'm talking to Theo van Leeuwen about his book, The Language of Colour. The book presents an introductory account of the role of colour as an aspect of visual communication. In this interview, we discuss the many uses and meanings of colour throughout history and across different cultures, the various influences on colour meaning from perception all the way to folklore, and the role of social semiotics in reconciling these factors. We consider how the meaning of colour has been exploited by artists and designers from antiquity through the Renaissance to the present day, and explore how the language of colour has come to such prominence in contemporary life. Today we welcome Theo van Leeuwen of the University of Technology, Sydney, to talk about his book, The Language of Colour. It's a very interesting and readable introduction to the study of colour as an aspect of social semiotics. Theo, you mentioned in the preface that colour is an underappreciated and understudied aspect of visual communication. How did this book come about?
Yeah, precisely because in my own work, also understudied. I'd been writing about visual communication and teaching about visual communication for some time. And at a certain point, about 10 years in, I suddenly started to realize that I had not talked a great deal about color, and I began to wonder why that was. And there were perhaps several reasons. You know, the first is that I just fell unwittingly into a tradition that had been there for several hundred years, where color had been somewhat undervalued, and this started historically in the Renaissance, when the vivid colors of the Middle Ages made place for chiaroscura, for the light and dark kind of gradations of paintings, rather than for expressing directly with colors. When the practice of artists changed in that they thought the work was really finished when they had done the design and they could leave the coloring to their assistants. Color became a bit secondary, and in talking about color, there was also this idea that really the essence of what communicates in visual communication is the design, and the color is a sort of secondary phenomenon that's added to it and at best gives some kind of emotive overtone or something like that. And so there's that. But also I realized that I began to think about it because I had a feeling that, as it were, color was coming back, changing the way color was being used. Changed. Color became all kinds of documents, that used to be austerely black and white, and never have a touch of color, became quite colorful, even sort of, corporate annual reports, textbooks, all kinds of things that used to be quite dry and dour became colorful. Websites, of course, are colorful, and color became very important in branding, and our whole world became, in a sense, more colorful than it had been. We used to have sort of, fairly drab colors of the public transport and things, and suddenly, these kind of things in the city became more colorful, people who would be partly dressed in gray began to wear at least colorful ties. And I felt color was got a new role and a new importance in society. So it was time to think about it a little bit more. And I began to work with my students, as always, to sort of develop ideas and read about color. And after having done that for a few years, I sort of recorded what I had learned and thought so far about color in this little book.
And you begin by tracking some of the ways in which the interpretations of color have varied across time and place, and the various attitudes to color that have been exhibited by artists and philosophers over the centuries. Does this inconstancy or instability surprise you when you look back over it?
Certainly, maybe it didn't so much surprise me, but it certainly made me more aware and just how varied the ways can be that the same signifiers, as we say in semiotics, the same colors in this case, can be given such different meanings and values in different times, in different cultures and even in different domains within a given culture. You know, and it showed, you know, it was turned out to be an important kind of subject for social semiotics, because in social semiotics we want to be semiotics, which means what kind of, you know, perceivable objects, like, or perceivable qualities of things like color can be mean or communicate or express what kind of things. But, you know, it being social semiotics, is that you also want to look at how does that come about? How do people create these things? And, you know, although there are certain discourses that think that, you know, the meaning that there are sort of universal deep meanings of color shared by all human beings, looking carefully at color across cultures in history shows, you know, just how different and how varied the things are that we can do with the same colors in everyday and sometimes in, you know, high art communication and expression. So therefore, I thought that color was actually a really good thing for social semiotics to focus on, and that some of the lessons we learn about that enormous variety, you know, we should begin to look at other modes of communication and also see how that same discovery, if you like, you know, applies to across the board, even in things that we think are quite stable and quite universal. That's not to say that there is nothing that is universal. You know, there are qualities of color, you know, that such as that they might be dark or light, that relate to universal human experiences. But what values there are given to that, and how these things are incorporated in specific communication or expressive sort of, you know, domains, that can still vary enormously. So yes, there's that's been really one of the things that struck me most about color, and that made this book a little bit different from other things I've written, because I had to pay more attention to that variety, to that historical background, to cultural differences, looking at anthropological literature, and so on.
And throughout your book, you bring out this interesting creative tension between the different levels of explanation that have been applied to colour, from the, if you like, very hardcore psychophysical approach of which cells on the retina perceive which colours, which are focal as a result of that, right down to folk stories, if you like, about the significance of one color and traditions about what constitutes a holy or a spiritual or a color with certain other particular values. Where would you place your own work on that continuum, or are you adopting a very holistic attitude to it?
I did look at a very wide variety of literature, because color has been written about in very many different contexts. You know, it's been written about as a physical science. It's been written by anthropologists, by philosophers, by historians, and so on. So I begin, you know, by, even though I'm always interested in the idea of semiotics, in the idea of how do we use, you know, materials, qualities of materials, movements, you know, sounds, and so on, to communicate. You know, that is the essence of it. I did want to sort of learn from a variety of things, but the big, of course, if you write a book, you must try and bring some order into all this variety. And so I was able to sort of see, you know, three main strands that sort of had specific historical origins in the Western history of color, but that now are all sort of present, and that are all ways in which we can talk and think about color. You know, we can think about color as symbolizing meanings, and that's, you know, was of course a very fundamental and central in the Middle Ages, through all these examples of, you know, religious color meanings, that symbolic religious symbolism of color in the Middle Ages that with the aid of some excellent historians in this field, I've been able to sort of write a bit about. Then came the sort of the age where of science, where from in visual communication, the color symbolism receded, and there were no more books published about the meaning of color and so on. And what was important now was to render color in such a way that it would correspond to reality, that it would look as much as possible to the way colors look in reality, in particular light circumstances and so on and so on, in which color also became science itself. And then more recently, you know, we have the sort of psychological discourses about color, in which colors have some kind of, you know, in which people have some kind of innate preference for certain colors that relate to their character, and in which colors can influence, can excite, can actually have a non-semiotic direct effect kind of influence on us, through, you know, can excite us or calm us down and so on and so on. So these different, these are three main tendencies that have dominated in different eras, and now we sort of seem to have them all together, but shifting a little bit in which things are dominant. And I think that symbolism, naturalism is still very important. You know, the main aim of photography, whether analog or digital, is still to have natural colors. You will find that, you know, repeated a lot. Same. That's still important, but symbolism is coming back. Not, you know, for example, in branding and so on, and is starting to play the meaning of color is starting to play a more important role, but now not in relation to religion, but more in relation to the sort of value system of our modern corporate, you know, global corporate color, which finds its expression in these colorful and new style of texts and in corporate colors and so on. But that's coming back. And at the same time, the psychological discourse of color is still very, very present. If you look at, magazines of interior decoration magazines, I've done a bit in my book, then you can find these kind of, you know, colors as expressing personality or character, it's still very strongly there, and in the discourse of color experts, that's still very, very important. So we have these different kinds of meaning now, but shifting gradually moving back more to the possibility of color of being symbolic, so where do I stand myself in all that? Well, I do believe that colors have specific colors that you encounter in specific circumstances have, you know, characteristics that that can form the departure point for interpreting them, particularly if we don't have a ready-made sort of scheme. So I'm not. I think we need to look at the nature of the physical nature of color and its aspects. But at the same time, I do not believe that that there are sort of universal color meanings. I think if you look at different, you know, at how differently people have interpreted and valued color in different circumstances, then becomes a little bit difficult to defend. And that is where I want to help my students, because given the scarcity of discourses on color meaning, when I started out thinking about it, or the idea that, you know, it just means whatever you want it to mean in a given circumstance, they needed a bit of guidance. And all they could find was these lists. Red means this, green means that, you know, which if you put them side by side, you know, are often very different and nevertheless have a sort of claim to discover a sort of universal scientific meaning or effect of color. So this is something, yeah, that the semiotician can't really believe in, and that the historian also can't believe in. So that's one strong point I make. And I also, the other strong point I make is that actually many aspects of our scientific theory of color leave out, make certain things central, for example, hue, whether it's red or green, which are not always and every time and in every context the central characteristics of colors as they actually as we actually encounter them. So anthropological examples often are very striking, that where people call two things that we think are very different colors, like red and blue, for example, have the same word for it, because what they first of all look at is not actually hue, whether it's red or blue, but some other aspects that to them, in the context of their world, is more important. For example, how much the color, how lustrous it is, how much it reflects light, things that are, you know, in the Western system have been sort of secondary. So so I think overall, you know, my bias or my interest is in understanding the how we create meaning, including that psychological meaning, but reinterpreting that as something that came about in a particular period, you know, for particular historical reasons, and rather than as actually being sort of universal truth. And that's how a semiotician would think about it.
Sure. To take up the point, you talk later about Berlin and Kay's work on the putative universal categorization of color. Yeah. Do you feel that work has been too ethnocentric and overinterpreted?
Yes, that is certainly an argument I make, that that in the main, you know, you have to be nuanced. There were some aspects of it that were of interest, but in the main, it has been it's taken the assumption that everybody sees color more or less in the same way and gives preference to hue, and it's used as its stimulus material, not colors in context, but sort of color charts, which are, you know, developed on the basis of theories and so on and so on. So I explain a number of reasons why that come out of the same kind of anthropological literature that they actually cite, and out of other sources, to question that particular theory. It has been very, very dominant, and it doesn't mean that you then, you know, that by rejecting that theory that you then end up not being able to say anything, and anything goes. You know, there are still principles to be discovered, and general principles of how we might look at color, but ones that actually just discover a sort of meaning potential, and that cannot be really understood unless you also understand and look at the context in which these colors are named, in the case, you know, because color names are very important for Berlin, okay, named and talked about, and how people use them, how they talk about them, how they interpret them, and so on. So, yes, I do take a stance against it, but at the same time, I want to say that there are degrees of universality. You know, there are certain things, like, for example, the difference between dark and light. That's an important aspect of any color as you encounter it. That is, of course, based on experience that all human beings have in common. But however, how they interpret it, you know, and what meanings of darkness and lightness they give the most emphasis in a given culture might still influence, you know, how, what dark and light actually are to mean and how they are actually interpreted. But yes, I mean, we need to look also at which aspects of color are related to universal experience, so that there is at least a basis for some understanding across different color systems, and some motivation for saying maybe we should choose this color or that color to express a given kind of concept, idea, or whatever.
One theme that is relevant to that I think emerges in your work is the idea that these dimensions of meaning are interrelated, and in particular, it struck me that the a lot of the aspects of color meaning are, in some sense, mediated through technology and technological change. Makes a profound difference to what is available and what interpretations are liable to be placed on these things.
Yeah, and that is absolutely, that's something that it's good that you mentioned that, because in much semiotics and also in thinking about language, technology has not been incorporated as being part of how you make meaning. It's been seen as just sort of a tool, and it's as though the meanings are quite separate from technology, but they're not. You know, technology both influences and is influenced by what people want to communicate and how they want to communicate it. So when specific colors, you know, when, and that again, you can start by historical sort of examples to show that, you know, when specific colors, you know, have specific symbolic meanings, then they've got to be exactly that color. You can't sort of shade it too much, because then they may become a little bit like another color. So you you have a sort of palette with many different colors which have their meaning, and these colors are also these meanings are not only based on, they're partially based on what that substance that, for example, the paint, say, actually is. You know, before the modern industrial methods, paints had to be made from all manner of substances that were often very hard to obtain. So colors had value, not just because of what they intrinsically were, but actually about how much they cost. And people who commissioned paintings would say, this particular color has to be it. And so how they technically were produced and what they meant were interrelated. Then you get, you know, not each individual color, you know, because also, of course, if you have such a very expensive color, the last thing you want to do is mix it with other things. You want it there in its purity. And in the age of naturalism and, you know, an emphasis on faithful, trying to make colors faithfully reproduce the world, there was also the age in which color mixing came in, and in which paint, therefore, did not have an intrinsic value anymore, in which you don't say, I must have this particular paint and undiluted. So you got a new technology, new kinds of paints, oil paints that could be mixed better, new kind of theory about color mixing, about meanings, and so on. Today we have again new color technologies that can make that allow us to do things with color that we used to do and that are now necessary. We now are, for example, color is now also used, you know, to organize and written text, to color certain kinds of content, to give them a different color, maybe as background or something, than other kinds of content, whether in magazines or textbooks. And we have software, you know, if you do HTML writing, then we can choose, and, you know, then we can have a style sheet, cascading style sheet, where we can have the color that will make, that will give a sort of unity to all the pages of websites, and sort of separated to some degree from the many, many other pages to which it is linked. You know, so we have new technologies that do new, that where you can do new kinds of things with color that we used to do. For example, in apply it to writing when we make PowerPoint slides, when we, you know, when we do various kinds of documents. We couldn't do that with a typewriter. We can't do it with our modern kind of thing. So what we do with color, what color is used for, what it means, and technologies, they influence each other mutually. But you can see that, you know, of course, avant-garde artists and designers in the early 20th century already began to do these things before we had these technologies that made it as easy as it is now. So actually, technology is always intricately related to making meaning, and in the case of color, you know, which is completely dependent, you know, the use of color for making things that mean or express things is totally dependent on the industries that provide the paints, the inks, the dyes, the nowadays the software, and so on.
point going back to the going back to antiquity that there was a that unmixed colours were prized for their purity. But presumably that was in some sense a technological observation, that because what were unmixed colours are of course not what we would consider primary colours on any definition, but were the colours that were available in particularly pure form, and which
that's absolutely. Although people classified color, they were not primary colors in the modern sense, you know, in the sense of these are the fundamental, you know, colors from which all other colors can be mixed. You know, the realm of colors was quite extensive. But I think in purity, you know, there is a, that's partially technical, but it is also a value system, you know, where purity as a concept, as an idea, you know, is highly, highly valued. And sometimes, and that can vary, you know, more recently in postmodern thinking, the opposite of purity, hybridity and so on, began to be highly valued and began to be seen as something dominant and something good. So it varies, you know, but there have been significant periods in antiquity and again, you know, in other periods where purity was a very important idea, and where the idea of purity could be expressed amongst other things by preferring pure colors. Just as, you know, other values like being restrained has also been often a key thing, you know, a restrained color. Too many different colors, too strong color, being too exuberant, too extravagant, you know, too hedonistic or whatever. You know, certain the values of being restrained, you know, have at times also been highlighted. So color schemes and ways of using color that relate directly to the, you know, the choice of colors. You know, have you got a very differentiated range of different colors, or you just use a few colors? All those kind of things can actually relate to dominant values in the culture, or the part of the culture where these colors are used in a particular way. That's another, you know, interesting aspect to look at, particularly when you look at what the dominant characteristics are of various color schemes that are being applied to different types of texts or media or whatever.
I found intriguing in that respect your brief discussion of the palettes adopted by various painters up to Matisse. In the sense of not the colors that appeared on the canvas or on the surface, but the colors which they worked with.
Yes.
Presumably that reflects some kind of tension between practicality, but also some kind of intuitions as to what is or ought to be primary.
Yes. I would be the first to say that this idea that I have, as you rightly say, only very sketchily indicated that idea. But that was because a lot of talking about the meaning of color has been always related to individual color. So, you know, coming back to the example, red means this, green means that, yellow means that, purple means that. And I began to think that perhaps today, you know, color schemes, you know, the are more important. You know, when in our modern technology, that's what we offer, color schemes. I'm having a little research project at the moment about PowerPoint and how it's used, and you can clearly see that built into the software are not just individual colors, although you can pick out one if you want to, but are actually combinations of colors that have been thought out by the designer and that you sort of can choose between. Then of course the idea of the palette of, you know, the painters becomes an interesting historical example to sort of see, okay, well, that's what they actually did. They actually decided in one way or another, these are the fundamentals that I need to do. These are the range of differences between colors that are my basic working materials. And quite different from the scientific schema of just, you know, red, green, and red, yellow, and blue, or something like that. So there is some interesting writing about, particularly by the excellent color historian John Gage, about the palettes of painters, and I could glean a little bit of information from there. But I think it's a topic that could be taken much further still than, and that we've really only made sort of the beginning of an attempt to see on the basis of what kind of parameters might you be able to sort of investigate the rationale and behind it, the choices of what is part of the color scheme or the palette. Yeah.
You talk about color harmony in some more detail in that same chapter, chapter 3. Again, this struck me as something that was interesting because of the way in which considerations, presumably from low-level perception, not quite as low-level as simply the detecting the colours to which we have retinal responses, but also some sort of higher-level organisation of the visual field, interfaces with this affective response to give you some idea of what is coherent and what it means if you put two colours together.
Yeah. Well, the first point there is that traditionally the idea of color harmony was entirely based on the theory of the primary colors, you know, and so and many people have put that in practice. So my sort of thought was that many people have thought similar things before, but not perhaps taken it then to the next step, that there are many other aspects of color that can make them harmonize, that the idea of harmony can be based on different principles, and that we don't only look on, again, not only look at, well, at you, but that we can look at a whole lot of other characteristics of any color as you actually encounter it. And not even just its darkness or lightness or its saturation, but other things as well. It's light quality, luminescence or luminosity. Whether it is pure or whether it is variegated. All these kind of things can actually form principles that make color, that create similarities and differences between colors. And of course, harmony doesn't only mean that they are all the same. Harmony in music, as I say somewhere, actually includes always dissonances that get resolved. So in color schemes, you also often find, some colors that actually, some elements that sort of make them similar, but also some elements that provide some difference and some punctuation in it. And so I'm searching for the principles, the many different principles that can make, that can be behind the choice of what palette or what, set of colors to use. And if you look at, so it's interesting then to look at, statements by designers about what colors they use. And I find it particularly interesting to look at fashion designers talking about color, because they actually talk often in that way. They sometimes, as things not in terms of what belongs together, but also in terms of things that that provide challenging contrast and that brings the whole to life and so on. So, the key thought is perhaps we would have to move today from analyzing from the idea that an individual color, such as red or green, has meaning, to thinking that, we encounter colors, that are deliberately produced to create meaning in terms, oftentimes in terms of color schemes. And while we might, while in a sort of color coding of traffic signs or underground, London Underground Railway things, each individual color definitely denotes something different. In the world of color that we have in our the objects we use, the clothes we wear, the use of color in magazines and on websites, color schemes would appear to be a more important thing to know how to talk about and how to interpret as the semiotic sort of idea or system behind how the colors are used in that context.
So in Chapter 5, when you lay out your parametric theory of color, yeah, inspired by the sort of feature-based ontological analysis, is that in some sense incrementing the basic colorimetric kind of approaches with this, with these notions of context and affect, or are you building anew from the ground up?
No, I mean, all those aspects have been, you know, I mean, I just bring together, you know, aspects of color as we encounter it that often have been remarked upon before, and that you also find discussed in anthropological literature as being important in different traditional cultures. But I sort of bring them together to sort of have a wider range of things to look at when you talk about the meaning of color. And as a sort of basis for how we analyze color, and so it's actually and the important thing is that it's not like a hierarchical system of primary and secondary and tertiary colors. It's a system which is of simultaneous, you know, of things that are all always present to some degree, but that can be admixed to you know, in the whole to different degrees. So, but to get, you know, but I also say, like, you can describe for each of those parameters a very broad meaning potential that is based on what it really is, you know, that the fact that it is actually light or dark or strong or weak, you know, in some kind of way. But what meanings, how people use these physical perceptual qualities of a given color in making meaning of it cannot be understood without also taking the context into account, you know. So you cannot ever have a decontextualized list of this is what it means. And I'm sometimes misunderstood that when I try to sort of describe the meaning potential of something, you know, people then think, okay, that's fine. I can now say dark means this and light means that. It's not like that. But there are certain characteristics of color that motivate and inform how, in a given context, people try to make, use color to make meaning. So you always got to study, you know, so you got to look at it in context. And that's interesting because, in a way, I sometimes think, I didn't so much say that in the book, but that much of our communication today is quite deliberately becoming more context dependent. It was, you know, for a time we've had the idea that we could write something and all the meaning would be in it and it would be exactly communicate the same thing and be exactly understood by everybody in the same way. Whereas now we realize that, you know, it's not so much that we realize it, but that we also create things to be used in particular context, augmented by people's reactions and interactions and so on. So the time is ripe to sort of indicate that, but for some domains where we have mandatorily fixed the meanings so that they cannot be interpreted differently and very explicitly, to a large extent, the meaning of color is not kind of fixed authoritatively by codes or so the equivalent of dictionaries or grammars, but is a contextual use of the potential meanings that derive from these color parameters. And so that it means that the meaning of color in those kind of domains where it isn't strictly codified remains quite fluid and can develop, you know, it's not held back by authoritative codes that prevent you from playing with it and creatively using that meaning potential.
If it's not an unfair question, what would an analysis look like within your parametric framework of color? I mean, what would be the object of analysis, and how would the analysis sort of
Yeah. Well, the object of an artist would first of all be to be able to observe, you know, even if you don't have always an exact metric, you know, and to observe, to be open to and observe all these qualities of color. So to look at things, well, you know, to try to have these terms to talk about and maybe to compare notes on, you know, with other people, you know, would we call this dark or where would we put this on the scale from dark to light or from saturated to pale and so on and so on. Then we would say, okay, now that's we've made an observation of these qualities. But what else do we know about what's happening here? You know, what is there a story, or is there how can we bring in some of the context to interpret why how that particular meaning potential is used in this given instance? So I give some examples, you know, of that kind of analysis. And so in that analysis, there's always a part of it that I believe we can reasonably agree, come to an agreement upon. You know, I think we can agree that the colors in one of my examples are very strong, and another example are quite sort of watercolory, wishy-washy colors. That is, you know, the next step is ultimately an interpretation, but the interpretation will be stronger if it is based on various kinds of arguments that relate, that place the use of color in its context. So that's really the plea that I make for interpretation. That's really what I try. So it could be that I recognize, you know, that I can see. It could be as when I, obviously when I discuss, you know, for example, Van Gogh, you know, then I not only note that, you know, the tension in his work, you know, to still be naturalistic, to faithfully represent color as he sees it, and to use color expressively for their inherent sort of symbolic potential. And but I also think that if you can then show that, you know, the artist had deliberately thought about it and has actually said something about it, that strengthens the argument. You know? So you can argue that, you can certainly argue on the basis of the painting by itself that you know, you can find out that the background is just a strong color and that he hasn't represented the environment in which the particular person who sat for the portrait was, so that it's more abstract. You can make those kind of arguments. You can also bring in other arguments, or you can bring in arguments of the kind that art historians, you know, and iconologists have always used, but that semiotic interpretations of images have not always used. So I'm for a combination of the historical methods and the analysis of what's actually there, and in a methodically enough way that you have at least a number of parameters that you can look at and that you can swap notes about and that you can make reasonably reliable descriptions of. And you don't straight away jump to the interpretation. You start with what's actually there.
You make the point when you go on to talk about the use of color in a very much more aware, self-conscious fashion in 20th century art, that some critics have failed to appreciate what the artists themselves have said about their intention in using color. That way you mentioned analysis of work by Barnett Newman.
Yeah. Well, I feel quite strongly about it because, you know, I think that I have come to the idea that artists and, you know, for two things, you know, in a time when there is actually much renewal, such as, for example, the crucial early 20th century, you know, avant-garde period, but also the Renaissance, you know, there tends to be, you know, a connection between the world of thought, you know, and the world of art. You know, artists are not the mythical, you know, individuals who draw everything from some kind of divine inspiration. They're part of their world, they read, and in times of innovation, they actually are very they are simultaneously ideas that come about by thinkers of various kinds, in the Renaissance scientists, but in the early 20th century, for example, psychologists, and these two things are part of the same culture, and painters painters of that kind are often, they are researchers in my view. They research new ideas, and they explore problems of various kinds and resolve them through their medium. So when the paintings of Barnett Newman, for example, are interpreted by his interpreters as just sort of dealing with existential angst, and they don't realize that he was actually a deep thinker about color, who just happened not to use words like me, but actually use color to think about color, then I find that a bit short-sighted. I'm not saying that that's the only thing, the only way you can interpret it, but it is an important dimension. So I'm trying to actually describe the work of artists as a form of research, as posing problems that have to relate to, for example, to color, and as seeking solutions for that. And in the case of Barnett Newman, again, we have somebody who actually also, like Van Gogh, said that in words. So the evidence is there that it's not a figment of my imagination, but that he was actually, himself seeing it in those ways too, even though the other side applies too, because he also gave later on some quite mythical names to his painting. So there was another element as well. But the element of it being a sort of research about color that we need to understand as such and articulate as such, that's often lacking from the critical literature.
Treating the developments in modern art as a form of research, do you feel tempted or inclined to back up your research, as you put it, in the form of words, with that kind of creative endeavor?
Very much so. I mean, I'm not myself a painter, so but I have dabbled in various creative arts. But what I would like to do, and what I do up to a point already, particularly here at the University of Technology, I'm very fortunate to be in an environment where we have a faculty that involves creative arts as well as academic disciplines. So to create collaborations with people involved in creative arts, where you can say, well, look, those problems, by semiotics being able to sometimes ask questions and expose gaps in what people do, and expose what people never do and never try to do with color, you could have a dialogue that and the outcome of it could be of different kinds, writing as well as various forms of artwork. And so we have here creative doctorates where students are developing not a thesis but a work of some kind. It could be an exhibition, or sometimes it's a film, or sometimes it's their musical work, because we got sound and music design here as well. But it has to be based on a process of research and discovery that then finds its expression, not in words, but in another medium. And for a semiotician who looks at different media and modes of expression and what people do in them and don't do in them and what they can do in them or not, it is also interesting to think, well, it's not only a matter of describing what is, but it is also a matter of playing a little role in what could be. So I also like, therefore, to draw attention to historical examples where precisely those kind of things happened, and where there either was a close collaboration between researchers or thinkers of various kinds and artists, or where artists themselves both write and about the ideas they're exploring and give them shape in actual artworks. So that's one theme that sort of emerges a little bit in that part of the book, but that I generally feel quite strongly about, and hope that there will be more sort of case studies of artists as thinkers than we have at present.
In the closing section of your book, you go on to talk about the use of color in terms of constructing persuasive narratives, for example, in sales for things like home decoration, makeup, and so on. Do you feel that there is a move away from the interest in color just being the preserve of the artist exploring these boundaries and, as you say, researching through the art, to people doing that in quite unexpected and in some cases quite mundane disciplines?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, and that may not always be the case, but I certainly think that things that have been demonstrably explored by artists and have been a domain of a fairly limited domain of experimentation that has a very limited public, have moved into the mainstream in many, many different ways. All manner of things that and that's a problem in the sense for art, because where does it go? And it's possible for people to still see an artwork as difficult to understand and as don't like it, and actually use precisely those same things in their everyday work. I mean, abstract art is now part of all sorts of abstract art that was difficult to understand, and that people say, is this really art? Actually, it's part of your sofa or your of everyday objects that you use, and that is unremarkable. Just as atonal and electroacoustic music, when people hear it in the concert hall, they say, this is not for me, this is not the kind of music I like. When they hear it as part of a television series, they don't think twice about it. It's completely normal. If you took the pictures of it, you would again see how much it is actually like, that very experimental, limited audience sort of music. So all these things have moved into the world, but not standing on their own as they do in an art gallery or in a concert hall, but being integrated in a multimodal, everyday kind of environment where they become much more unremarkable and much more commonplace and sort of are constantly observed, but not necessarily always, consciously thought about. And so they become very much the landscape, they become very much a big part of the landscape in which we live.
Our time is nearly up, so I have to close, but I must ask you in doing so about the cover art of your book, which is very striking.
Yeah.
A work by Charles Tuff.
Ah, well, yeah. I just said, basically the first time around they came, I just wanted the books to have a splash of color and to to sort of jump out rather than so that was really all. And the first designs that they sent me from the publishers were very, very pale and very, very geometrical, and very much sort of just generated with a little computer program. And I sort of wrote back and I said, well, I've been disappointed with that. I would really like the cover to make to sort of say, look, color, talks to you in a general sense rather than it's been. And so they said, what kind of thing do you mean? And I sent them a few pictures and they said, fine.
What does this one say to you in particular?
I chose it not to, I haven't actually, the truth is that I haven't analyzed in detail, but what I wanted it to say in this as a cover is that color is not some kind of effect that, in this case, in this book, that sort of recedes behind the foregrounded clarity of the words that are printed on top of it, but it stands there all on its own and asks you a question: what is this? You know, what am I going to think about this?
Well, David does that very emphatically and well, as does your book, and I've very much enjoyed talking to you about it. Okay. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Theo van Leeuwen about his book, The Language of Colour. This is Chris Cummins for New Books in Language, saying thank you for listening.